Good morning.
Because it is the last day of spring break,
I thought about making just the sermon about how to deal with depression and deep sadness, but I thought that wouldn't maybe apply to parents, that parents are perhaps in a more joyful mood. But we'll be in Luke chapter 10 this morning, if you'd like to flip over there. We'll camp out there in Luke 10, so if you get your Bible situated there, you'll be in good shape for the lesson. This parable arises out of a question. This parable of the Good Samaritan that we'll look at is one of the more famous pieces of Jesus' teaching. It's one of the things that if you were to go and just ask most people in the world, have you heard of the Good Samaritan? They would have some familiarity with the story and the idea behind it. And it comes out of this question that Jesus has asked during a discussion. And we find here that not all questions are created equal. It is possible to ask the wrong question, and we find that example here. You can imagine a situation where somebody is telling you about a new Mexican restaurant that they went to that opened up here in town, and they're telling you kind of about their evening. Then they say, you know, then we went out into the parking lot, and it was really dark and crowded, and there were lots of cars, and I actually got hit by a car in the parking lot. The appropriate question after that is not, yeah, but how were the chips and the salsa? Right, you've missed the point of the story. Well, the person that Jesus discusses this idea of serving God asks the wrong question. But thankfully for us, he does. Because the question that he asks is the same question, likely, I think it's safe to assume, that you and I ask and struggle with and wrestle with how to live it out as we faithfully serve our God. And we find here Jesus using this question as a launching pad to say, if you want to boil down what it means to follow God, what does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? Jesus will helpfully narrow that down to something that sounds simple to execute, but in reality can be very difficult. Well, let's start in our text, Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 25, and see the question that sets up the story. Luke 10 and verse 25. And a lawyer stood up and put Jesus to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit the age to come?" And Jesus said to him, "What is written in the law? How does it read to you?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You've answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." But wishing to justify himself, the lawyer said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" So we have the original question where the lawyer stands up, which was a sign of respect. Teachers sat. If you were asking or engaging with your teacher, you stood as a symbol of their authority. So he stands and says, okay, what do I need to do? What parts of the law are the most important? What things does God care the most about to make sure that when God's kingdom breaks in, I'm on the right side of that? And that was a very typical question. Jesus was not the only teacher to be asked this from the period, nor the only one to give an answer. There's a story predating Jesus of two of the most famous rabbis are both asked that question by a seeker. And one of the rabbis' answer was, "Whatever you hate, don't do that to someone else." And he says that's the whole law. Everything else is commentary on that principle. And so this lawyer has come to Jesus. Well, what do I need to do? Jesus, as a good teachers often do, turns the question back. Well, what do you think the law says? And so the lawyer takes two passages. He takes Deuteronomy 6, that you need to love your God with every part of your being. And he takes Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. And he combines those two together. And Jesus acknowledges that's the right answer. Why are you at? You know what the right answer is. You've told it to me. You just have to go and do that now. Go and love your God and love your neighbor as yourself, and you will inherit the age to come. But the lawyer wants to press further. In verse 29. But who is my neighbor? I know I need to love God. He has an understanding of who that is. Yahweh, the God of Israel. I know the God that I'm to love, but who is the neighbor that I am to love? And he's attempting, Luke says, to justify himself. And he's, I think, asking the wrong question because he is assuming the answer in the question. He's trying to lead the witness to tell him what he wants to hear, because inherent in his question is the assumption there is a class of people that are not his neighbor. Who is my neighbor assumes that there is somebody out there, there is some group of people that doesn't fall into that camp. Some people he must show love to, and others he doesn't have to. It presupposes limits to his love. And that's what Jesus wants to pick up on and use as the launching pad to his parable. But we need some more background first. And if you'll indulge me here, I hope this will sharpen up the story that Jesus is going to tell, because we have lost a lot of the significance of saying the Good Samaritan. For us, the Good Samaritan is just a nice man or woman out there who sees a car broken down on the side of the road and gets out to help change the tire. It's just being a nice person. But for the first century Jews, when Jesus wants to talk about a Good Samaritan, that's an oxymoron. Those are concepts that don't go together, because there had been centuries of hatred and violence between Jews and Samaritans. And I want to just chronicle a brief segment of that history so we can feel the real sting of the parable that Jesus is going to tell. The origins of the Samaritans are murky, to say the best. It's not clear exactly where they originate from, and it kind of depends on the sources that you go to get the information, with with Jewish views and what survives of Samaritan literature from much afterwards. They give very different stories, with sort of leaning one way or the other depending on who they favor to begin with. But it seems that when Assyria came and conquered the northern kingdoms of Israel in 722, that they remove a certain segment of the population, and as was Assyria's custom, they would take people from other parts of their empire and move them into the new location. And the desire is, you're scattering people and you're intermixing and intermarrying. You weaken the culture that lives there and you create something more favorable to Assyrian control. And so Jews would say that that Samaria came out of a mixing of whatever Jews were left and then whatever Gentiles came and mixed together. And that's where Samaritans came from. Samaritans would say, well, no, we are the remaining remnant of faithful Israel. We are the ones that truly go back to our father Jacob. And so they claim both to be the true people of God. And then from that, they would have some theological differences. Now, a lot of what they believed religiously were the same. They both believed in one God, in monotheism. They both believed in circumcision. They both believed in following the law of Moses. They both believed in observing the Sabbath. But they also had lots of differences. They claimed different segments or different spots for worship. Jews said we worship in Jerusalem. Samaritans say we worship on Mount Gerizim. Samaritans observed the law of Moses, the first five books, but not the other books of the Hebrew scriptures, where the Hebrews claimed to observe all of it. Samaritans claimed that their priesthood was the true surviving priesthood that had fled Judea centuries before. And so they are staking out positions. We are Yahweh's, we are the God of Israel's favorite people. But it did not stay as isolated theological debates about which parts of the scriptures do you need to obey. That it broke out into real animosity and fighting. Centuries before Jesus, and again, this is a funneling down of lots of examples. Centuries before Jesus, when the Jews were not under self-rule, they were controlled by, might be easier if I trace it this way. So Alexander the Great comes in and he conquers most of the known world for them, including Israel. Well, he dies, the kingdom splits into four, and the Seleucids take over what is now Israel. Well, a descendant of one of these rulers, Antiochus, hated the Jews and made it his mission in life to eradicate the Jewish people and the Jewish faith. And so he, you know, what was coming in to disrupt the temple and to defile it, and he banned certain Jewish practices. And so there's a lot of hatred for Antiochus from the Jews. And so they start to revolt against this evil ruler. Well, the Samaritans during that period disavowed any relationship with the Jews. They claim to not have any relationship or ties with them, to not be of a similar religious pedigree, to not be on their side in the rebellion. because they didn't want the brunt of Antiochus' armies coming down on them too, so they pushed the Jews aside. The Jews would remember that and say, you betrayed us in our moment of need. You did not help us when we suffered under Antiochus. Well, you go a few decades after that, to 128. After the Jews had kicked the Greeks out, they had regained self-rule. You have this Hasmonean period where you have Jewish rulers over the people. One of them, John Hyrcanus, made it his mission to remove all Jews from the land that he considered unfaithful. So he was going through attacking towns and executing people that did not uphold the law. Well, he goes into Samaria and he destroys the capital of Samaria, including the temple there. So Samaritans remember that event and say, yes, but one of yours came to our town and killed us and our temple. You go after that to about 6 or 7 AD when Jesus is just a boy. Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, records that Samaritans came into Jerusalem during the Passover and scattered bones in the temple, thereby defiling the temple during this most holy period. So now there's even more hatred and animosity. Then you jump a few decades after Jesus to AD 50, when some Galileans are traveling down to Jerusalem to worship. They go through a Samaritan village, and Josephus says they were attacked by the Samaritans and executed. Now, whether Josephus tells that story right and whether there was some kind of fighting on both sides is irrelevant, but because what we see is it's not that these people just didn't like each other. They didn't like the clothes that they wore, the way that they talked, or the food that they ate. They hated each other to the point that they had no problem killing each other. That's the Jew and Samaritan relationship. One, and again, many more examples we could multiply this. One Jewish writer in between the Testaments, he writes a book called Ben Sira in which he classifies all of Samaritans as a foolish people. And he differentiates between Jews and others, Samaritans and Gentiles being in that other category. So with these things in mind, Jesus' parable becomes even more stark in the way that he chooses to end it. So let's read it. Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 30. Jesus replied and said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers. And they stripped him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. And by chance, a priest was going down on that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion, and came to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them, and he put him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn and took care of him. On the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, take care of him, and whatever more you spend when I return, I will repay it. Let's pause it there. So our opening scene is of a robbery. This Jewish man is evidently going down from Jerusalem back to his home in Jericho, which was a rocky, winding descent down with lots of crevices and cracks and caves. And robbers like to use that as a spring where they could hide and attack travelers. And the first century was rife with these types of robbers because you've got Roman occupation, which was creating lots of economic hardships and the difficulties paying taxes. So there were a lot of people in a lot of desperate situations. And so robberies go on the up. And so this man is attacked by these robbers. And evidently, he fought back. Robbers only stripped you and beat you if you resisted their attempt to get your money, which evidently this guy did for him to end up in such bad shape where they beat him half to death, strip him of his clothes, and leave him to die on the side of the road. Then Jesus says, by chance, a priest is coming down as well. And he comes upon this man lying on the side of the road, beaten, motionless, naked, and he's got a decision to make. This priest is probably coming back from Jerusalem after his service in the temple, with lots of priests making this commute back and forth from Jerusalem to Jericho. And he comes across this man, and he has to make a decision, because the law tells him he's not allowed to go and touch a dead body. Leviticus 21 says a priest is to keep himself removed from the dead. And so he has a decision that he has to make. Now, there's something behind this that is perhaps lost on us as 21st century readers compared to first century readers, with the priest being of a higher status. He's of a wealthier class and would likely be riding an animal down. And so perhaps he's got a choice. Does he throw this man on top of his animal and help take him to safety? But what if it's a dead body? And he goes up to the dead body and he touches the dead body. Now he is defiled. And what's even worse, what if it's not even a Jewish dead body? What if it's a Gentile dead body, and he comes up and he touches a defiled Gentile body, and now he becomes defiled himself? So the decision for the priest, what is more important right now? My purity, my strict obedience to the law of God, or the risk of compassion to go and help him? And so he decides to cross to the other side of the road. The law required about 4 cubits of space between you and a dead body, which is likely why he goes to the other side. He will keep his distance from this person, this body, lest he become defiled himself. And the only way he would know, I mean, because there were certain lessenings of these restrictions if it was a Jew, that if he knew that it was a Jew who was hurt, he could go and help him without much of a consequence. But the only way he knows is to go and get close to him. The only way he knows is to take the risk. But he chooses to cross and to keep moving. Then following shortly thereafter him, in verse 32, is a Levite. Levites had lots of different functions. What though is probably the connection being drawn here is Levites helped serve and tend to priests while they were doing their temple functions. And so with the priest leaving and the Levite coming there after him, seems that that's what he's been doing while in Jerusalem. And so he is used to his life being about service, about tending to somebody else's needs who is too busy or preoccupied or worried about cleanliness to do that themselves. And so he comes upon this injured person, or possibly deceased person. And he's got a decision to make too, and he's in a sticky situation because the priest has already set the tone. The priest has decided, yeah, this is too risky. I'm just going to keep moving. Now, if the Levite shows up in Jericho with this guy, well, what does that then say about the priest or about the Levite's concern about the priest's precedent, about what the priest has taught? It's the priest, after all, who is the preserver of purity, who's the bearer of that mark, and he has ignored his precedent. And so he chooses to cross to the other side. But then comes a Samaritan. The traditional way this story should have gone, and this is where we see the difference between a parable and just a good moral example, the way the triad would work, you would go priest, then you'd move down a step to the Levite, then you move down another step to your average, ordinary Jewish person. And that is perhaps what the listeners are expecting. That he's going to say, all right, the priest didn't do it, Levite didn't do it, oh, but the common Jewish person did, and hey, look, you're a common Jewish person, you can do that too, would be the expectation. They would not expect but a Samaritan came. And Jesus' disciples likely would not expect, but a Samaritan came. The last chapter in Luke 9, Jesus is going to Samaria, or he approaches Samaria, and the Samaritan towns reject him. In response to that, James and John say, do you want us to pray for God to send fire down and destroy these cities? That is their response to Samaritan rejection. They don't think very highly of Samaritans either. And now here Jesus is saying, but Samaritan comes down on a journey, the hated Samaritan. It's not a moral tale to give us a nice moral example. It is to so disrupt our expectation of the world to take what we think is the normal course of action, to take what we think are the normal actions of people or categories that we've constructed for ourselves, and it explodes them and says, now you've got to rethink the entire way you've looked at the world. Because a Samaritan comes down and acts with compassion rather than a primary concern for purity. And so he comes in verse 34. He feels compassion for him, and he bandages and cleanses his wounds. So we can tell from that, this guy was in pretty rough shape. These weren't some minor scrapes and bruises that this guy had. He is in a near-death experience. And so he's cleansed by the oils from the Samaritan, and then his bandages are wrapped to give him some relief and some comfort. These oils that were being used to cleanse wounds, there may be some humor in what Jesus is saying here, because Jews were prohibited from accepting oil and wine from Samaritans. And so the humor would be, this guy who's half dead, if he was to maintain a sense of purity, would have to tell the Samaritan who's trying to heal him, I'm sorry, I can't accept your medicine. I can't accept your help right now. So it may be a bit of humor on Jesus' part there. But he accepts it, and the Samaritan then does what the Levite should have done. The Samaritan stops to aid him and to serve him when the Levite crossed to the other side. He then takes the injured man and puts him on his donkey. Now, if the priest himself was riding on a donkey, then the Samaritan is doing what the priest should have done, throwing him on top of the beast to give him a ride down to a place of safety and security. And so the Samaritan then continues his descent down to Jericho. The expectation would be, the Samaritan might be able to take him up to the outskirts of Jericho, but he would need to stop. And he would need to stop there, unload the Jewish man, and the Samaritan would need to go on his way, because the Samaritan would not be welcome in the town. And just, I hearken you back to those examples that we just looked at, in which people are killing each other all of the time and desecrating and making things unclean. So there's a real apprehension about letting a Samaritan come into your village. So the expectation would be, well, you just dump them off and you keep going. But the Samaritan doesn't. He goes into Jericho. And then he returns the money that had been taken from him. The Samaritan spends the night there in the inn. And we might need to update this language, although this isn't still a couple hundred years old. But I think we'll get the picture. Imagine we're back in an old west mining town, and somebody's gone missing. And up we see in the horizon an Apache Indian coming with this missing person from the town strapped across his horse. And the Apache comes in and he gets a room in the hotel and he spends the night with this injured person in the hotel room. What would the townspeople think? Well, is it his fault that he's hurt? Well, haven't they been attacking our town before? Are we really sure we want this guy here? And that Apache may wake up to a mob scene circled around this hotel. Samaritan, in the same way, could wake up to find that there's a whole town full of Jewish men who are angry that he has disgraced their town so much. And yet, he takes the risk to spend the night with the injured man. He then gets up the next morning and he talks to the innkeeper. He says, okay, here's 2 days' wages to take care of him. And I'm going to come back through here, and if there's any money left, just write up the bill and I will pay it. If this guy was to wake up, let's say he's incapacitated for a week. It takes him a week before he can get up and actually start moving and getting where he needs to go. If he was to wake up with a huge debt racked up that he can't pay, they wouldn't say, yeah, well, that's, I guess, just too bad that you got yourself into a hard spot. They would say, well, you still need to pay us. And if you can't pay us, then you have to go into slavery until you can pay it. So he would be in a very vulnerable spot when he wakes up. The Samaritan, though, doesn't see his obligation as ending the moment he leaves. He says, I'm going to make sure that this guy is taken care of into the future. And then we get to the punch in verse 36. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands? And the lawyer said, the one who showed mercy to him. Then Jesus said, go and do the same. The lawyer echoes, intentionally or unintentionally, Hosea 6, with God desiring mercy rather than sacrifice. Who is it that acted like a neighbor? Right? It's not the priest. It's not the Levite. It's the hated Samaritan. Because the Samaritan did not think in categories of people to love and not love, but showed compassion to the one who was in need. So a few conclusions. Asking the question, who is my neighbor, is the wrong question. Because the point of the parable is to explode the limits we often put on who I must show love to and who I can not show love to. The lawyer expects an easy answer. He expects Jesus to let him off the hook. He expects Jesus to say, here are the people that you have to love, that these people over here, you can keep on hating them. And that's really easy to fulfill. I can live up to that command. If you say, well, I have to love my family, that I can do. If you say I can hate somebody else, well, there are plenty of people that I would like to do that with. And that would be an easy command to fulfill. But Jesus says, there's not another person in that category, though. There's not a person over there to say you don't have to show your love to. He classifies all people, including the most hated, into the camp of a neighbor to show love to. The interesting experiment would be to run that parable back through, but to change the names. Because I haven't met any Samaritans, at least not that I'm aware of. And so, and we are really good at this. We are really good at splitting camps, saying there's a red team and a blue team. Right, there's these jerseys and these jerseys. And you can like this group, but you have to hate this group. We find it, because the world is much easier to digest that way. It's easy and simple to think of good guys and bad guys. So who could we run this through? Maybe the punch at the end of the parable is a Trump supporter. Or maybe it's a Clinton supporter. Or maybe the punch at the end of the parable is the NRA member. Or it's the anti-gun activist that comes at the end. Or maybe it's the white person at the end. Or maybe it's the black person at the end. Or maybe it's the undocumented immigrant at the end. Or maybe it's the ICE agent at the end. Or maybe it's the Muslim at the end. Or the Christian at the end. Maybe it's the police at the end. Or maybe it's the Black Lives Matter group at the end. See how easy it is for us to think of two groups. You have to choose sides. You've got to be with them or you've got to be with them. And Jesus says, that's not how we do things. There is no group of people, there is no class of people that you do not have to love, that you don't have to show compassion towards. And notice, for Jesus, for the Samaritan to show compassion, that was not just an inner feeling on his part. It wasn't just, well, I kind of like that person. They're kind of nice. Or I should think about them a certain way. He does something about it. To show love is to show action. And so we must have hearts that pump something other than blood. They pump a love for the other person. And that becomes a distinct... I mean, trace this back. Okay, how did this parable begin? It began with the lawyer asking, what is the most important thing I have to do? Boil it down for me. This is a long book. Simplify it for me. He says, you love God, and then you love your neighbor. And then classifies the neighbor as everyone. If you want to be a Christian, you do that. The rest is commentary. He displays a true love for his neighbor and what it means to be a follower of God. The Samaritan, the one that they would think is the bad guy, shows what it means to follow God because he has understood what the others did not, namely that God loves him and that love then goes out. It's to show compassion even for those we would classify as our enemies. And the parable then, and this is the difficult part, has to be lived out. The point of a parable, right, is to disrupt our thinking. It's not to give us a step-by-step set of actions that we can just follow and know how to get the end result. We've got to figure out what it would mean for us to live this way in our present culture and context? What would it mean to show compassion like the Samaritan does? When Jesus talks about the kingdom of God being like leaven that slowly spreads, it doesn't tell us how that spreading happens. We've got to figure that out. Similarly, what is the loving thing to do in a given situation? It's not always going to be the same. What is in the person's best interest is not uniform across the board. We've got to figure that out. So what this parable does for us is it gives us an identity. It says, this is who you are. This is the type of people you are to be. Go and do likewise. But Jesus isn't a type of teacher who simply tells you what to do and then does not do it himself. From some of the earliest interpreters in the church looked at this parable and began drawing immediate connections between Jesus as the Samaritan, the one who came on a journey, the one who was hated and despised, but the one who sacrificed and risked and made himself vulnerable to help those who were beaten and suffering. And it is he that is calling to us this morning to say that he would heal us if we would only let him. That he would heal us and make, and not just for today, but that he would take us and provide for us into the future. And so if you need to respond to him this morning, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.